Hello, and welcome to another edition of Rainer Hirsch's Proms in the Pub. My name is Rainer Hirsch, and this is my deeply unauthorised podcast about the BBC Proms at the Albert Hall. Before we get into this edition's guest, don't forget you can get in touch with us at www.promsinthepub.co.uk, leave us some feedback, and listen to every episode in the series so far. In France, they say merde. In Italy, in the mouth of the wolf. In Russia, the phrase is neither fur nor feather, to which the recipient replies, go to hell, apparently. But in English-speaking countries, performers wishing one another good luck say, break a leg, though nobody can quite remember why. The complete opposite of good fortune, maybe? Perhaps bowing looks like you might have broken a leg? Who knows? But last week, it was reported that conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, Kirill Petrenko, had taken it all too literally and actually broken a leg, requiring surgery, which sounded grim. Over the last few days, this has been downgraded to Kirill Petrenko having only broken a toe, which is inconvenient but less grim, surgery not mentioned. Perhaps later we'll hear that he had in fact only broken a toenail. Whatever, it is injury enough for him to cancel his participation in the second Proms concert being given by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra on September the 4th. Mahler's 1 hour 20 minute 7th symphony on September the 3rd can be performed on a broken toe or whatever it is, but the second concert, the other concert, the one I've got a ticket for, can't. Daniel Harding, all of whose toes are intact apparently, is taking his place, and the Shostakovich symphony they were going to play, this, has been replaced by Bruckner Symphony No. 4, this. Super disappointment, or as they say in France, merde. The other news is about the news, I suppose. How much it varies. Except, of course, on the BBC, where everything is permanently super wonderful excellent. The Telegraph newspaper has run articles headed, why is the BBC intent on ruining the Proms? Others have described them as excellent. A couple of days ago, I was surprised to see a concert I attended, which featured César Franck's symphony in D minor, described in The Guardian's awesome and characterised by powerful, sweeping nobility. I felt it was a bit non, frankly, with some sloppy playing from the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The only thing on which there has been universal agreement was the Gaming Prom on August the 1st, a concert in which the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra played music from video games. All serious commentators tried to pretend it just wasn't happening. I thought it was great. Who can resist a concert which has a piece called Final Fantasy VIII, fantasies 1 to 7 having not been quite so final as previously advertised. Our news, that César Franck concert, which also had the Brahms Violin Concerto, was a Proms in the Pub outing, included in our next episode, in which Tom Walker, who has created the ranting political correspondent Jonathan Pye, would appear. Tom was a Prom and I concerts virgin, and it was great to take him to see his first prom and hear his reactions to life listening to music without being able to sit down. Listen for that, coming up next Thursday. Our other attendee was a man who has participated in every episode of this podcast. When Proms at the Pub was first conceived, I wondered out loud to producer Julian Mayers whether Harry the Piano might be cajoled, bribed, or drugged into taking part and contributing a topical treat at the end of each programme. Regular listeners will know that is just what he's done. Now, as we move into the final weeks of this series, it's surely time to meet the man behind such wonderful concoctions as La Donna e Mobile and Tchaikovsky given the Strictly Come Dancing treatment. Where does he come from, Harry? How does he do it? Ladies and gentlemen, this is our audience with the great Harry the Piano. Pleasure it is to have Harry the Piano in my house. Not
Wowzers.
Only
wowzers,
it is. It's absolutely, you know, you're
In fact, I think people basically listen to our podcast just to get to you. I mean, they have to put up with this waffle beforehand. They have to cut through a few adverts and then finally get to the decent bit. You mentioned when we were, before we got on recording, that you went to Latimer School, is that right?
I did, yes, in Hammersmith, not just down the road from here.
Yeah?
Yeah. And yeah, that was brilliant teaching. I was a scholarship boy. You know, my parents, we were the proverbial church mice. My dad was a vicar. And he aspirational regards education. Two working class kids, my parents, in effect. And they both wanted for me, my sister and I, to have the education that they didn't have, and the classic story. And did quite well in the entrance exam because I grew up without TV and was just immersed in music, classical music only, and books, because that was my father's.
Can I probe how old you are?
Now?
Yeah.
Yeah, 58 now. Right. Born in 64.
We're the same generation. So yeah, you didn't have a TV. We didn't have a TV. No, not until I was 13. The moon landings.
Moon landings, no. Not even that.
Not even for that.
Blissfully unaware. Yeah.
Let me tell you.
We've landed on the moon.
Yeah. I don't want to break the news too.
Yeah, no, spoiler.
Spoiler alert. Kennedy's dead.
Yeah, oh, wow. Okay. Well, there are huge holes in kind of the knowledge that you glean from having those kind of news sources in your house that come back to bite me in the arse when I'm taking requests, and people ask for the tunes that everybody knows, except I don't, because I didn't have a TV, so I missed that theme tune. But in many ways, advantageous, because you read more and you listen to music more.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what sort of set me off on the trail. It's just, you know, I had this kind of, and then walked into the scholarship with amazing musical tuition, and also the kind of teachers that weren't too ruler on the back of the knuckles about doing the scales and arpeggios, actually gave you some encouragement about improvising and going, taking sort of left turns that most people were discouraged not to do in a traditional way. So that all kind of fed into where I am now, which is earning my living as an improviser. And then when I was 4 years old, some church member donated us, we came into an upright piano, which is like the new toy arrived in the house, and that was, yeah, and I started picking out tunes with one finger, thinking that like this was something everybody did, and they said, oh, there's something there, we should send him to the organist for the lessons, and that's how I started off having lessons at 4 years old. So check this out, this is quite an interesting thing. Do you remember Listen With Mother on Radio 3?
Yes.
With the foray. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yes.
Exactly that. So that tune was in my head from whenever it was, 5 years old. But I'd never played it. I'd never learnt it, because obviously at that age it's far too sophisticated.
And it's not something ever. It's a duet as well.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you. It never crossed my sort of repertoire. And then about, what would have been 20 years on, I'm sat in the Groucho Club playing, and there's some guy, it might even have been Stephen Fry. Because he was in there every night, that's why I think that. And asked, can you play, do you know that, the Dolly Suite that they used to do? And I'm thinking, oh yeah, I know that. And I sat there and played it almost perfectly, you know, sort of. And I was thinking, and then I remember stopping thinking, like, I've never learned that. And I know it from 20 years ago when I wouldn't have had the proficiency to understand what was happening. But somehow it stayed in my brain, unscrambled, and now just directly down into the fingers. And I go, that's weird, isn't it?
Yeah,
I'm not trying to aggrandise myself, but it's an odd thing.
It's more than weird. It's astonishing. Yeah. So people who can't do that, which is 99.999% of the kind of piano playing public, essentially you remember things on the piano and the chords and the sound and the, you know, where it is on the piano in the same way that other people remember speech. And even that is an unusual thing to be able to just rattle off something, but nevertheless, that's how it is for you.
That really is, yeah. And I'm asked this endlessly, what's in your head when you're doing it, you know, when people will throw 10 requests at you and say, can you play this tune, and then so you and in this different style. So
yeah.
Can you play Match of the Day as a Strauss waltz, and then can you play the theme to EastEnders and the start of Debussy? And so you've got all of these requests up there written on a piece of paper in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's the links that are the fun things.
Right.
I mean, but the actually doing those things, you can't possibly think in real time at that speed about what chord, what inversion, what key am I going to play it in. It's an instinct, an instinctual muscle that you kind of have an idea, okay, that's how Debussy would have played that tune. You add in a whole tone scale, you add some of those kind of cathedral englouti type harmonizations, and it just comes out. I mean, it's not very erudite description of
what
happens. No,
let's hear some cathedral englouti. So just those sounds, just some chords. Which, when you just said, you mentioned Debussy chords, what are you talking about?
Okay, so give me a tune, give me like a simple diatonic
tune.
Three Blind
Mice.
Three Blind Mice.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, you're straight in the soundscape straight away, aren't you?
That is amazing. I mean, that is like, it's just, I know to you, and that you've had this conversation 100,000 times, well, a lot of times.
Yes, lots of times.
Because people just sit in awe because they have no understanding of how that could possibly be, because if you struggle.
Well, see, that's the thing, isn't it? When what you and I have in common, I think, is we play on the comedy of that's inherent in that juxtaposition of high art and low art. So if you're playing EastEnders in the style of Rachmaninoff, it's inherently comic, isn't it? Because you're making this big, grandiose kind of musical edifice out of the somewhat unpromising material. And that's like, I have a Mozart sonata based on the theme tune to Scooby-Doo. Sonata based on those themes, which is, I mean, it kind of, people always laugh, especially when you come out of the intro and then you get to the, and that's, it's just to hear that ridiculous tune played in the style of Mozart, there's people just start laughing. It's the same with the thing that you featured the other day, the Moonlight and Night and Day married together in the style of Beethoven, you know. First one of those I ever came up with. And it was so seductive that I played that, and there was this ripple of laughter around the hall. And I think people are laughing, so there's no words here. They're just laughing at the stupidity of going, of kind of morphing so seamlessly from Beethoven into Cole Porter. There's something inherently comic about it. Dudley Moore did it, Victor Borger did it, and all those people. And I think you're right, it shouldn't be denigrated. I think it's a funny, it's clever, it's witty, it's slightly irreverent, but it's an inclusive thing, and it's giving people access to two different things at once, and it's instinctively funny, I think.
Yeah. You touched on some names then of people who've done this kind of stuff before us. Well, I mean, I feel that, there are very few people doing this matching of low and high art.
Yes.
The way you put it, I think it's a very good way of putting it. One of the big names was Victor Borger. And I know you mentioned, I think, and some of our exchanges, Borger, or we've had some story about that. And I did actually a programme about Victor Borger with Julian, who's in this room now with us. It was actually the beginning of our first series about musical comedy called All the Right Notes, Not Necessarily in the Right Order. And that comes from the Eric Morecambe, Andre Previn sketch where Eric Morecambe is trying to play Grieg Piano Concerto. Andre Previn comes over to him and says,
"You're playing all the wrong notes."
And Eric Morecambe grabs him by the lapels and says,
"I'm playing all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order."
That, by the way, has become a catchphrase which I've heard, balderized. It gets, as does the name Victor Borger, because when you say you do this kind of thing,
yes.
You're too young, but do you remember? There was a man, I think he was from Sweden or somewhere.
I think he was Scandinavian.
Scandinavian or somewhere like that. And he was a bit named Victor
Borger. Exactly right.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
And do you know what happened after that show that I made with Julian? I got so interested in Victor Borger's story and using the interviews that we recorded in Denmark, I actually wrote a play about Victor Borger. Which I did in Edinburgh, and then I did on the West End, actually. I've done those Victor Borger routines more times than
you know them all.
Okay. I know them all backwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's just to touch back on what you were saying, there's three questions. If I'm doing this to an English audience who aren't a specialist musical audience, the three things will always be, I think he was from Sweden, regarding Victor Borger, which everyone will come up to you and go, not necessarily in the right order.
Yeah.
So you get those, and what's the other? They're always, yes, what star would I was going to ask you for Les Dawson. It's like every time these names crop up. And they all have that thing in common, don't they, of messing around with the styles. But Victor Borger, I mean, my parents, the two ways was they would let their hair down in car journeys when the classical music behind it was like, after about 3 hours on the way to Scotland or something, we'd go, "Can we please play something else?" The two sort of bits of light relief were some old Victor Borger cassette which would come out, what was the other thing? Flanders and Swan.
Yeah.
So that's the stuff that I grew up on. That got sort of imbued me with the love of cabaret and just thinking, like, this stuff is brilliant.
Yeah.
It's not just funny. There's more to it than that. Yeah. So I heard all the Victor Borge stuff, and it just made me laugh out loud. I just completely fell in love with it. And this is a good story. Imagine this. So one of the duties you have to do occasionally on a cruise ship they call it a guest entertainer, you're on to do a couple of after dinner shows, is you have to host a table, a group of random sort of passengers, usually with a few single ladies or widows, you know, and you're there to steer the conversation away from sex, drugs, rock and roll, politics, everything else. And ensure they all have a wonderful time and bat your eyelashes at them a bit. And there's this really sort of nice old lady, and she was sort of saying to me, you know, I really enjoyed your show, and who were you influenced by? What made you sort of do this thing? So I mentioned Victor Borge, and she sort of looked at me, and she said, I'll tell you a story about him. I went to one of his gigs, and I was really heavily pregnant, and I was sat in the front row, and it was in the round. And he saw me straight away and made a beeline for me, and he said, I hope that's not going to arrive during my show. And then he said, and every time kind of he walked past, he made some reference to it, and it became a running gag of the show. And then at the end of the show, he said, ladies and gentlemen, you may think I've been a bit ungallant to this lovely lady here. The truth is, she's carrying my first grandchild, and it was his daughter. And she hadn't let on until that point.
Right.
And I nearly dropped my soup spoon. It's like kind of, I'm sat, hey, for real? And then she said this thing, which I've since shamelessly plastered all over my website. My father would have loved your show. And it's like, take me now. That's sorry, knocking my own microphone. It was just such a magic moment to have that endorsement from Borge, who is like, for me, I know you've done it that many times, you're slightly sick of it, but...
No.
It's still, for me, he is the royalty of musical cabaret.
She sings an aria, the so-called die aria. She seems very happy about it.
Okay, so can I just ask you, because this is an element that Victor Borge, I think, was troubled by. Do you ever feel a lack of legitimacy in what you're doing? That you're being talked down to, like the people saying, what a shame you didn't do this or what or that?
You know, that yes, that did used to bother me, but it comes from the audience. It doesn't come from performers. I mean, I get to strut my stuff in situations that truly terrify me. The two things are like, I'll do a gig for, there's a chap called John Wilson, not the conductor. John Wilson, who was head of piano accompaniment at the Royal Northern for many years and is greatly loved and has played with everybody who's passed through that kind of whole Northern music scene. And once every 5 years, he has a birthday party and they wheel a fleet of 8 grand pianos into the Royal Northern, which is this huge sort of 600-seater auditorium. And they do these fantastic arrangements of Tannhäuser and things for 8 pianos. And they also, the pianists that come also do little sort of solo things. And you've got, I mean, it is the cream. It's like Peter Donohoe, Martin Roscoe, Noriko Ogawa, I mean, all these people. And I'm one of the pianists in this field, so there's like 8 tailcoats hanging in the dressing room. Mine's the 8th, you know, like next to Peter Donohoe's and Martin Roscoe's. Can you imagine? I mean, I feel like, I remember the first time I turned up to rehearse in the afternoon and Peter Donohoe and Martin Roscoe were doing some duets. I said to the audience, I feel like I've kind of like taken a wrong turn in my Ford Fiesta somewhere and ended up doing laps in Silverstone, you know, in this little car while these things are going past you. They're always incredibly kind, those people, and they will say to you, you know, after the show, like, I wish I could do what you do. And that, I mean, that's a really nice thing to hear from people who you've grown up listening to and these kind of, huge edifices of Radio 3, you know, respectability. And also the kind of like being asked to do stuff on Radio 3 by the presenters also that you've known for years, Sean Rafferty and all those people who love taking and playing with different composer styles and that. So you have this, that also, by the way, is terrifying because you know when if you're on Radio 3 doing some show and you're doing something, someone says, can you play Brahms Lullaby in the style of Richard Strauss? Your heart is racing. And somebody said to me once, why do you find it so frightening? There's only sort of one man and his dog ever listening to those things. And I say, yeah, but even the dog has a degree in ethnomusicology. Because you know there's some Oxford Don somewhere, you know, going like, that's not Richard Strauss. God, man, what is this rubbish? So it's frightening, you know, when you consider the upper echelons that are listening. But the truth is that kind of most people are incredibly kind. But the audiences sort of just see your technique and think, why aren't you doing this on the concert platform?
Yes, I mean, I think that is I think it's looked down on, generally. My gut feeling, myself.
Well, you're a clown, aren't you? But I mean, I just like, you know, I play up to that. I take through the white tie and tails, but I have like big dotty socks, like a clown. Right. And I used to put a bust, but upside down on the piano, so right. I'd see if people noticed that it was like classical music turned on its head, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, there is that thing that people say, it's very clever, but it's a slightly wasted talent, isn't it? As you get a little bit of that.
Yeah.
But I'll fight for its legitimacy because I think there's not many of us that do it, and you'd miss it if it wasn't around. So I think it's hugely important.
So do you think you'd have got to where you are today? I mean that not in any sarcastic way. Had you not taken that turn that you described?
Not in a million years, no. No, I don't have the classical technique to sit playing Rachmaninoff and Liszt and everything else, even Mozart, you know, to do it properly. And nor would I want to. It's not something that could... I mean, I love it. I love being immersed in it. I know most of the classical repertoire, but it's not for me. I love what I do much more. I love doing a show where every show is different. And I love the fact that if somebody says, can you play, as you say, you know, Three Blind Mice, but can you make it sound like Shostakovich or Jerry Lee Lewis? And when there's a laugh, you're doing it, they go out thinking, we did that. We made that laugh because we created that, you know, that kind of those things. So we were part of it. And I love the interactiveness of that. And I love that it's fresh every time. And I love that it's slightly edgy because you never know what people are going to ask you. I've released two CDs in my life, and they both come from audience comments. The first one was that I was playing that Beethoven Moonlight. And because Night and Day is written in E-flat, and this was quite a long time ago before I became quite so fluent in all the keys, I start the book, no, Moonlight in C minor, so you can do the transition into the E-flat of Night and Day. Got like a bar and a half in at the Egham Music Society. And somebody shouted out from, in the wrong key! Shouted out in the middle of this routine, you know, with like an audience there and everything. And then I went into Night and Day and there was a laugh, and his wife, I think, died the death of a thousand cuts and came up and apologised to me after. So I'm so sorry about Frank. And so that was that. So my first CD is called In the Wrong Key, which I love as a title. The second one's called All the Way Through,
yeah.
Which is exactly what you said. Why don't you play something all the way through?
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you have that comment enough, you have to, rather than kind of like fighting it, you have to realise everyone's thinking this. So you have to find a way of dealing with it. So I start the second show when I don't get the chance to do these two shows. I'll come on, sit down and play this piece ostensibly of Chopin, a little Chopin etude, which gets quite fancy towards the end. And everybody claps. And I say, I played that because I've been asked so many times to do something all the way through. And who, by the way, who do you think it's by? And they all say Chopin. And I say, no, actually it's by a lesser known British composer, Harry the Piano. Because this is the sort of thing I wrote in the style of Chopin when I was a teenager. And it's kind of nice, but that sort of shows them, you know, that you can do something. But it also gets you off the hook of having to learn something difficult because you write it yourself.
Now, we're talking about the problems in this. Problems yep. in the pub.
Yes, yes.
And tell me about your experience. So I phoned you up and I go, we're doing this series, Problems About the Problems. What was the first thing popped into your head?
The Albert Hall, you know, obviously being inescapably the venue, and it was like the Holy Grail for me in the Albert Hall. You know, I was in the Boys Brigade, and once a year you'd have like the Boys Brigade annual show would be in the Albert Hall. I remember my father taking the first prom about the age of seven, which was Mozart's 40th, and actually seeing an orchestra. It's just a mesmeric experience for a kid, you know, and seeing as how that music was so important in my life, I was being surrounded with it all the time with no other sort of influences. So the Albert Hall was, you know, as soon as you say anything about the Proms, it's this huge kind of warm, chocolatey feeling that I'm enveloped in. And actually, one of my sort of fondest moments ever, where I did this charity thing in, it was called SOS Villages for AIDS in Africa in the 80s. And it was like a pop audience. It's people who'd never been in the Albert Hall and never heard classical music before, and they got this orchestra together. And about sort of an hour and a half in, they were very fidgety, you know, because they're just not used to sitting there listening, being silent and like not kind of clapping every few minutes. And I was sort of called in to do a sort of bit of light relief, and my parents were in the front row there. Like, I'm going to do 10 minutes. So, I explain this to Ali Jones, who's hosting it. And he said, so we'll collect something from the audience as a suggestion. And it was to play some Wagner in the style of, I can't remember what it was. Wagner in the style of something. And then he said, we'd sort of prearranged this because he wanted to, have something sure and set rather than sort of winging it, which I would have been happy to do, but they were sort of slightly nervous about this. But then Ali Jones, bless him, said, off the bat, said, and could you throw in some Kylie Minogue? So I start playing this Wagner, and there's kind of people are sort of understanding, okay, that sounds a bit like Ride of the Valkyries, and then we can see that he's doing something else. So there's a little laughter. And then I start bringing in I Should Be So Lucky in the right hand up the top. And then suddenly there's belly laughter. And because it's a release, because they're all been fidgety and had to sit there, it got a far better reaction than it probably deserved. So there's like this at the end, you know, and my mum and dad are in the front row and everything. I'm thinking, take me now again. That was the Albert Hall is anything to do with that, anything to do with the Brahms in the Albert Hall is fantastic for me.
I know that you've also played for the Queen, haven't you?
Yeah, I have played for the Queen. That was courtesy, really, of Alexander Armstrong. You know, once a year, you know, the Queen's a member of the WI. I think she's the patron of the WI.
She's got to be the chief.
She is the W in WI.
Yeah.
And once a year, she goes to her local branch, which is in a rather lovely little village hall in Sandringham, and they organise some entertainment. So they had Alexander come down, and apparently the Queen loves Pointless, the quiz show. Right. Goes out on the BBC. So they did a kind of Pointless without the screens. And the Queen won. It sounds like a fix, but she actually won because she hit one of the things on the nail. They couldn't do it with all the computers. So they said, how many people do you think said that? And the Queen said, 12. And it was indeed 12. It wasn't fixed. So that was hilarious. And then I was doing some requests. And I said to this very safe audience, ladies of a certain age, a couple of tunes to improvise on, ladies. And of Jerusalem and the National Anthem. I mean, you know, wow, he could have knocked me down with a with an Acme ton weight.
In Thailand, you'd be executed for doing
probably,
that.
Yeah. But then I said, what style would you like it in? And you think you're going to get Gilbert and Sullivan, what might come out. But what I hadn't counted on was this slightly rebellious woman in the back row who's a spring chicken at 65, put her hand up and said, reggae. So the first thing I played to the sovereign was the national anthem in reggae style. So there we are. There goes the knighthood. Hey!
So, yeah, if you're looking down a programme, what's the kind of thing that you would choose to go?
Actually, my kind of main thing I enjoy the most, probably do the most, is listening to chamber music. You know, so that's, of any description, really. And just anything Mozart, really, as well. Mozart I've been obsessed with since I was a kid because... And it's the first sort of style, it's quite an easy style to get into because it's so, you say the word diatonic, you know, you probably want me to explain that. I mean, you can play it on the white notes. That's a diatonic scale. So as soon as you start bringing in the black notes, you've got this chromaticism, which tends towards another style. So this very sort of open classical style that everybody knows, Mozart. And what I love so much about it is when you try and start dissecting it, it's so simple on the page. You know, you could write a tune using only the notes of just that. 200 years later, I'll just clap you the rhythm. And everybody knows what it is. Well, you've even played a note. I mean, that's fame, isn't it? You know, you're just using the most obvious tools. And then again, you know, he'll take that same chord and just play. And straight away, it's so distinctive. It's just a triad. It's just a sort of a million. There's 10,000 of those in every Beethoven sonata. But Mozart concocts to do a sort of inversion of it that is instantly. Why is it so different? Because you've got this string quartet, which you really should have nice big spaces between each note of the chord. That's what you're told to do when you're learning orchestration. But he puts this. Two right close together at the bottom, viola right down the bottom of its register, the violins a third apart, and this huge two-octave gap between the viola and second violin. I mean, like nobody had done that before. He just found ways of changing the most simple things and making the most memorable tunes using the most obvious tools. So I suppose that was my route into kind of playing in the style of Mozart, Alberti bass, and all those kind of things are quite easy to emulate.
Would you indulge me and just say,
sure.
You know, what are if let's go through some composers. Somebody says Bach to you. What is that gesture you're thinking of? Bach.
So with Bach, I mean, it's the first. If you're trying to sort of evoke the style, you do it. I always the sort of first thing that comes to mind is what you learn as a grade five pianist, which is two part inventions.
Yeah.
So you take off a tune like. And you know, and start playing it, breaking it down like that, and try and repeat the phrases kind of a bar's length. So you sort of, you give the essence of playing in a round or a fugal, contrapuntal kind of style. I know I'm getting a bit arcane here with the language, but it's just that thing of like you start one voice and then the next voice starts a bar or two bars later playing the same thing. So and it's like singing in a round, you know, and then it builds up and it's the more voices you add, the more complex it becomes. So it's like playing chess in three dimensions. But that instantly says Bach to me. Or else, so that's the clever way of doing it, or else you just start peppering it with well-known Bach quotes. You know, that's the cheats way of doing it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So okay, let's just talk about Beethoven. So somebody says Beethoven, and what are you thinking then?
You would explain it to the audience by saying that Beethoven is essentially Mozart on a very angry day. But of course, I mean, the characteristics of Beethoven is that he doesn't use... That's not Beethoven. Why use one note when you can use 16, you know? And then there's like... Sorry, is that blasting you out? I'm sorry. So huge amounts of notes, very angry, and also lots of kind of swapping around the register. So you've got either side of the harmony going on in the middle. There's lots of little things that are very distinctly Beethoven, and certain chord progressions that he uses. Lots of, I'm going to use one of those words again, Neapolitan six. Which Mozart does use, but not as much as Beethoven right. does. So,
indulge me. One in that style you just did. Let's have the high art, low art. I don't know. You name the tune. Let's have a Beethoven version of.
This is the thing.
News at 10?
Is the people read.
I don't know.
News at 10.
Oh God! Dun, 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 dun. No, is that?
Hard tune to do. it doesn't end on it. That is a mother of a tune to ask to do in the Beethoven style.
What do you fear? What are the things you... Oh, God, there we go again.
People are asking... I mean, the news at 10 thing is funny. When you get a tune that's just... that in the very sort of well-known bit of it sort of lands on a fourth or something and so, you know, has a slightly odd shape to it, but is a well-known tune, so you can't pretend that you don't know it.
Yeah.
But just does not lend itself, and it's, you know, that's, I don't really fear it, it's just more of a hassle being able to turn it into something that's kind of musically pleasant as well as kind of like funny, and so you're trying to juggle these balls all the time.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you this slightly self-aggrandizing story because it's one of the best turnarounds of those I ever got. Somebody in the audience said, can you play the theme tune to Jaws? It's famously two notes.
Yeah.
In the style of the Jersey Boys. And it's a big laugh because it's kind of funny, you know, and it's kind of ha, ha, ha. But then where does that leave me? And I'm thinking, shit. And then suddenly, some l'esprit d'escalier descended on me and I thought, oh, that's a... You should be laughing and applauding at that point, Ren. That's what they did.
I didn't want to cover the sound.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So sometimes you get little escape routes offered to you like that. But if they set out, there's only going to be one winner if somebody sets out to thwart you. They will win because you know they can ask for something impossible.
Regular listener Janet Hattam, who is in Australia, hello, hurrah. Janet, asks, is it possible, Harry, for you to create a fanfare, maybe in the style of Snoop Dogg, maybe Young, Wild and Free, that track, something like that?
Oh, OK. I know it well. Young, is that the...
So this has been the episode about Harry. Well, we're not going to cut to Harry. We have Harry here. One final piece, if you don't mind. Any ideas? Two contrasting ideas.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to sound preset, and it is preset in as much as I've done this before, but it's quite a fun thing. Do you want me to show you the two things?
Or, absolutely. Yeah.
So there's an opera by somebody. I think this is the only piece I know about this guy. Balfe, do you know anything about him? He wrote this opera called, I think it's called Bohemian Girl.
One-hit wonder, but better to be a one-hit wonder than a no-hit wonder.
That's correct, yeah. And I used to do this with a couple of singers called the Opera Babes. I was touring with them, and there's this lovely tune. Very sort of staid Victorian parlour tune, played by some accomplished young woman in a high neck dress called Kitty, you know. And somebody once asked, could you do that tune in the style of Winifred Atwell, who's the old Stride pianist responsible for Black and White Rag, the old snooker tune. See, that is perfect, isn't it? That very staid thing and that kind of ridiculous. Anyway, so it sounds like this.
So much, Harry.
Well, you're welcome. I've enjoyed every second. Thanks for having me.